Good afternoon and Happy New Year. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody along with Steve Goldstein. With our partners from the world, we'll keep you up to date this hour with national and international news along with stories from Metro Phoenix and Arizona.
Early next year, SpaceX is scheduled to launch, headed to the International Space Station. And among all the cargo and everything else on that mission will be a worm.
While in space, that worm will be infected with salmonella so researchers can find out how germs and their hosts may change under microgravity. It's the work of ASU researchers led by Cheryl Nickerson. She says this experiment is based on previous research her team has done. I spoke with her from Kennedy Space Center in Florida, where she was getting ready for the launch.
We want to further our understanding, our knowledge of how intestinal pathogens cause foodborne disease. We secondly want to be able to prevent that kind of foodborne illness from happening in astronauts when they're in flight. And then one of our main goals is to actually translate the new findings we're learning about how microgravity impacts the infectious disease process and translate those findings into new strategies to combat infectious disease right back here for us here on Earth.
So what are the practical impacts of what you might find out? I mean, are there problems right now with infectious disease among astronauts?
Yes, astronauts do get infectious diseases in flight. The good part about that is they don't get a lot of infectious diseases in flight. Our work has shown that for at least one pathogen, which is the leading cause of foodborne illness due to any bacteria in the United States, and actually the leading cause of death due to any foodborne pathogen in the United States, which is salmonella, we have shown that when we grow salmonella in microgravity, it becomes a better pathogen. It becomes what we call more virulent. But what was really very exciting to us is when we looked at the genes that were being switched on and off in response to the bacteria being cultured in microgravity and spaceflight, they weren't being switched on and off in the same manner that we know they are when we culture them down here on Earth. We care about this because we're actually learning new ways about how pathogens cause disease in our bodies. Life evolved under gravity. And when you greatly remove or reduce that force of gravity, that allows us, it allows the cells to tell us some of their secrets that they can't down here on Earth, where the force of gravity can actually mask some of their responses.
I'm curious about what you're talking about with some of the uses that we might have here on Earth, because, you know, given the fact that the space shuttle through NASA isn't really a thing anymore and there's less human space travel, it seems, I'm wondering if the impacts of what you might find on this mission might be more applicable to people here on Earth than astronauts in space.
That's the major emphasis of our work. Well, it's an absolute thrill and honor to work to keep astronauts safe in space flight. One of the main foci of my team's research is to translate our findings back down here on Earth. And our long-term vision is to come up with new therapeutics or strategies that we can bring back down here on Earth for the general public, because infectious diseases is always among the leading causes of human morbidity and mortality worldwide. So we're desperately in need of ways to outpace the pathogens. And so that's any new platform that allows us new insight in terms of how the disease is happening in our body should definitely be pursued. And spaceflight and microgravity research has that potential, and it's already shown us some new insight.
This research basically involves a worm and a pathogen, right?
It does. This will be the first experiment where the entire infectious process of a living organism will be conducted in microgravity, where the disease-causing potential is actually measured in real time. And this little worm has been used for many years as a human-like model to study foodborne infections, because it basically has an intestinal tract that's very similar to that of humans. We're trying to use microgravity as a way to kind of get both the host and the pathogen to unveil their secrets, because it's that dynamic dance that occurs between both of them as they're battling to see who wins that determines whether you're going to get the disease or whether you're going to come out unscathed.
Cheryl Nickerson is a professor in the School of Life Sciences and the Center for Infectious Diseases and Vaccinology at the Biodesign Institute at ASU. The launch is scheduled for January 6th.
A new exhibit at the Heard Museum looks at the evolution of games and sports among American Indians and their participation in professional sports. Beautiful Games includes 1964 Olympic 10,000-meter gold medalist Billy Mills' shoes and tracksuit, pitcher Allie Reynolds' baseball glove, and memorabilia from Jim Thorpe, among many other things.
Marcus Mononucket is the herd's assistant curator. He says he'd been kicking around the idea for this exhibit for a while, but decided to go for it when the NFL announced the Super Bowl would be coming next month.
I did start with early games of skill because it really, there's a lot of representation of that material in our collection. So you see that and you see the paintings of games and those types of activities. So there's a lot of material in our collection. And I knew it would be in other people's collections too.
So we're standing in front of this case that talks about early games of skill, and it looks like it's basically bows and arrows. Is that what we're looking at here?
Well, you are looking at some bows, no arrows. There's a dart, and there are hunting clubs. They would use those. The little kids would practice with them, you know, and throw them for accuracy. It's eye-hand coordination. This is a case called Early Games of Skill, which were really competitive games, but they also taught you a lot about what it takes to survive in this type of society.
How much of some of, especially the early games, really were about teaching skills and making sure that kids growing up knew sort of how to eat and how to fend for themselves and that sort of thing?
Well, it was pretty holistic. Your whole life was kind of around that. You know, people often say Indians didn't have a name for the word art. It's kind of similar. It's just all-inclusive, you know.
At what point did American Indians start playing what we would recognize as the sports that are played today, games like baseball and basketball and football and things like that?
Well, most of those were introduced during the boarding school era, so it was the late 1800s. Of course, they played similar racket games, so, baseball or hockey, football, of course. They had games that were similar that they would kick with the ball, sort of like more like soccer. So they were used to these field games. So if you look at the history of, like, the early stickball games, it didn't have boundaries, and games went on forever. So it was a little more introduction to, like, the bounds and the rules, and that was mostly through boarding school.
I think for a lot of people, when they think of American Indian athletes, the first name that comes to mind is Jim Thorpe. Is he considered almost like the American Indian version of someone like Jackie Robinson is to baseball?
Absolutely. I mean, Jim Thorpe was the first American, all-American. He was coming up during a time when media was developing and the newspapers were being disseminated further, and people got to read about these feats, you know, and what he did was will never be repeated. You know, he was an amazing athlete, and he could do boxing, basketball, whatever he tried, to even ballroom dancing.
When American Indians were sort of coming up through the ranks after Jim Thorpe, did they face the same kinds of discrimination and challenges that members of other ethnic groups came upon when they were trying to make it big?
Oh, yeah. Just like African Americans or any other ethnic groups. I mean, Jewish Americans or Irish Americans being integrated into the larger society. I mean, they all started off with their own separate leagues, and then the integration started with Jackie Robinson. But these men, too, I mean, they were actually given more opportunities to compete than African American people were given at that time. It was just that kind of that allure of the Indian, you know, that, like, and they would also not only play hard, but they would do shows, you know, they would dance, they would dress up too for some events. I mean, the Oorang Indians, which was the team that Thorpe started, which only lasted a couple of years, that was one of their things, is to do a show along with the game.
What do you hope that people who come to see this exhibit will take away from it?
A lot of different things. I expect a lot of different generations to come, and so I think each one will get, you know, something different if we talk about just the generations. But each person, of course, we're all being different, will get something different. But I think the main lessons are just American Indians' contributions to very similar things that all people do.
Marcus Mononucket is the Herd Museum's assistant curator. Beautiful Games will be on display through the end of November, and by way of full disclosure, the Herd is an underwriter of KJZZ. Still to come, getting a head start on energy saving in 2015. That story's in 20 minutes on KJZZ. Now let's get a news update.
Good afternoon. This is 91.5 KJZZ.
KJZZ is supported by Friends of Animal Care and Control, funding spay-neuter here in the Valley to end euthanasia of adoptable pets. You can make a real difference by making a year-end tax-deductible donation at SaveShelterPets.org.
Around the state right now, partly sunny skies and 22 degrees in Flagstaff. It's sunny and 41 in Tucson. Fair skies and 29 degrees in Prescott. It's partly sunny and 44 in Phoenix at 2:30.
BBC News. Activists say more than 76,000 people were killed in Syria last year, making it the deadliest 12 months since the conflict began. The UK-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says about a quarter of the dead were civilians. Altogether, more than 200,000 people have been killed. Dilma Rousseff has been sworn in for a second four-year term as president of Brazil. She promised to boost education, health services and security, as well as tackling corruption and investigating a major scandal at the state-run oil company Petrobras. Reports from the Gambia say dozens of people have been detained following Tuesday's suspected coup attempt against the country's leader, Yahya Jammeh. Troops loyal to President Jammeh are reported to have been conducting house-to-house searches for opponents. France's crash investigation agency is sending a specialist team to join the search for the wreckage of an Air Asia aircraft that went missing off the coast of Indonesia. The team will focus on trying to detect signals from the flight recorders of the Airbus plane. The French economist Thomas Piketty, whose book became an unlikely bestseller in 2014, has turned down his country's highest award. He said he was refusing the Légion d'honneur because he didn't think it was the government's role to decide who was honourable. Official Japanese figures show the country's birth rate slumped to a record low in 2014. The number of babies born stood at 1 million, falling for the fourth consecutive year. The estimated number of deaths has continued to rise. Two women identifying themselves as Italian aid workers kidnapped in Syria have appeared in a video urging the government to do more to win their freedom. The video, apparently filmed in mid-December, appeared online on Wednesday night. It purports to show Vanessa Marzullo and Greta Ramelli, who were abducted last summer. BBC News.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com.
You're listening to The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills, in for Marco Werman. Many folks, like Marco, are taking a much-deserved holiday today. So we have a skeletal production crew here at The World on this New Year's Day, and we got to talking about some of the highlights from our show over the past year, and we decided to share some of them with you and pull back the curtain just a little bit to give you a sense of how we do what we do every day at The World. One of the things you should know is that when you work in a newsroom, you're never truly on vacation. As my colleagues William and Clark can attest, William Troop is our soccer-mad editor, and Clark Boyd is the captain of our ship today, our show producer. They were both on vacation when we called on them to report on a really important news story, and I mean really important, the World Cup. It was the match between Belgium and the U.S.,
There is no more important story than the World Cup in 2014, I have to tell you.
I know.
And Carol, as you well know, every important story this past year has had Belgium in it.
Absolutely.
No, but we're talking about June 2014. I was on vacation in Brazil.
You were on vacation, but of course we called on you. And
I didn't mind.
I remember you just being over the moon because you thought this game was going to be kind of ho-hum. And then it was anything but.
No, it was super exciting, actually. One of the highlights of that game that I really enjoyed was that Tim Howard, the goalie for the U.S. team, he had an amazing game. He had 16 saves. And I want to play a piece of tape from that game, courtesy of ESPN.
Digging out that pass is the dangerous.
So what you're hearing there is the ESPN commentator, Ian Dark, describing the saves. And this is kind of a collection of them. Let's hear a little bit.
For a solo goal. It's very promising. Beautifully done. It's Morales! Again, Tim Howard's legs deflected it. Oh, it's a brilliant piece of play by Morales. Cut back, Fellaini. Now Hazard! Again, Tim Howard, who is having one of the games of even his distinguished career.
I really enjoyed that because I'm a goalkeeper and I was watching one of the best performances by a goalkeeper ever, really.
And I have to say, being in Belgium for that was equally as exciting. I mean, you know, having lived in Brussels for a couple of years, I kind of adopted the Belgian team. So I was really torn watching that match.
But one of the reasons the world called us also was the day before to kind of set up the match. Our fellow producer here, Andrea Crossan, called me and said, you got to have a shirt, you know, so we can take pictures and put it up on the web. And so I had this quest. I'm like, oh, damn, you know, I left my shirt in this other Brazilian city where I was, and I had to go find the shirt. And finally, I found one, took a picture, sent it in. And I didn't know Clark was having a similar odyssey in Belgium.
Well, I mean, for me, the shirt was the entire story because I was looking for a Belgium shirt to take over with me. I didn't want to have, because I figured maybe I could get it for cheaper here in the States because these things are very expensive over in Europe. So I went down to, like, the big soccer store here in Boston, and I'm looking. They have all the official jerseys from all the World Cup teams, and I'm looking through, and I'm looking through, and I'm looking through, and there's no Belgium. And I go up to the woman working the counter, and I said, excuse me, miss, where's Belgium? And she looks at me, and she said, what's Belgium? Well, it's a very good question, actually. But so I was on this quest to find one, and I looked all over Brussels when I was there, and I wasn't finding it. And I was on a bus going through my old neighborhood, and all of a sudden, I look out the window, and I see this mannequin wearing the official Belgian jersey. I pulled on the chain, stop the bus. And I ran out and I said in my very broken French, you have the official jersey, I want one. And she said, you know, I'm sorry, sir, but the only one left is on the mannequin. And I said, we'll take it off the mannequin. I want it. Here's $100. I still say I got the last official Belgian jersey in Belgium.
And it looked very good on you.
Thank you.
Wow.
So, believe it or not, we're going to stay on the World Cup for a moment. One member of our staff became really obsessed about the subject, and she wasn't at the World Cup herself, but she became so obsessive that she enlisted the divining power of a small cat from a local zoo here in Boston.
Oh, the sweet growl of Izzy the ocelot from our zoo here right in Boston.
And that's the sweet sound of Nina Porzucki, one of our talented producers.
Why, thank you.
Nina, what's the deal? How did this come to pass?
Well, I became a little bit obsessive, as you know, about the World Cup. And if you remember Paul the Octopus from the previous World Cup, who made all these predictions about if Germany was going to win, I thought, like, why? We should have our own predicting animal. And I had a lot of ideas I brought to the show producer from having our own guinea pig in the newsroom who would do every single game. That kind of got nixed. Me doing it at home by myself, to one of the producers offering her dog to do it. And then I was talking, actually, one day, I took this really, really intensely, to a veterinarian, because I was trying to figure out, like, will a guinea pig do a prediction? Like, are they driven and motivated by food? Would they actually even do some sort of predicting exercise? And the veterinarian kindly took my request seriously, and she said, you know, you might want to reach out to the zoo because they've done predictions before for Patriots games and that sort of thing. And I thought, why not? So I called the zoo and they were pretty excited and they set us up with Izzy. He's a Brazilian ocelot. He's beautiful. If you don't know what an ocelot is, it's sort of like a dog-sized cat that looks sort of spotted in stripes.
Did you get to get up close to Izzy the ocelot?
As close as I could get with some bars in between us. The most exciting thing is when I actually went there and we did some predictions for all of the U.S. games, and Izzy was pretty good at doing his predictions. I felt like I was a journalist going out there and doing some nature video, and I just wanted to play the fun clip from the Belgian U.S. game, which I will say Izzy got right.
4 is 1, 2, 4 is 5. You can let Izzy out now.
Head for. Okay. Let's see what he does. Oh, he's out. He's active. He's going straight to Belgium. And it's Belgium for the win. Belgium for the win. And they did indeed win.
So I want one clarification.
Sure.
Did he go up to a bowl of food that said Belgium on it?
No. There were two bamboo plants. Turns out ocelots really like bamboo. So there was one potted plant that had a Belgian sign and one potted plant that had a U.S. sign. And whatever plant that Izzy went to munch on first was the winner. He just used his divining powers and he was correct most of the time, 75% of the time. Anyway, it was a real joy because we cover a lot of serious topics rightfully on this show. And so it was a real joy to actually do something a little bit fun.
And it
fluffy.
Was fun.
Thank you.
Cats aside, the beauty of radio is the human voice. You get to imagine the rest, what people look like, dress like. But getting that voice to sound just right can be quite a challenge. To talk about that challenge, I dragged producer Shireen Jafari into our studio. And Shireen, tell us how hard it is.
Well, Carol, as producers here at The World, our main goal is to get guests to sound good, to invite guests to talk to you. And what usually happens is that we have guests on Skype, phone, or the studio. The studio, obviously, is the best option, but that's not going to happen all the time. So sometimes we have guests on phone or Skype. And I want to play you a clip, Carol, of what you would hear if you were sitting here in the studio with me and the engineer, of the conversation that goes between the engineer and the guest trying to get them to sound good. Here's what it sounds like.
Hello. Hi, Mike. Good to hear you. Can you hear me well? Okay. So I just go left, 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 center, 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 right, right, right.
Okay. Is this a good enough connection for you?
Yeah. I mean, if you just tell me what you had for breakfast.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I had my usual breakfast, which one egg over easy and two pieces of whole wheat toast with homemade blackcurrant jam.
That last answer, Carol, is the classic answer that we get from guests. We know about what people have for breakfast, maybe more than anybody else does, just because of the questions that we ask. And usually the answers are not that exciting. You know, people say, oh, I had toast with coffee. And that's the usual answer that we get.
And of course, it depends on what time zone they're in and you're talking to them. Breakfast may have been hours ago. But do you have a favorite answer to the breakfast question?
Funny you should ask, Carol, because I do. A couple of days ago, we had a reporter, a Boston Globe reporter who's based in Rome. His name is John Allen. And he had one of the best answers to that question that I can think of.
You know, Italians are not very big on breakfast. Probably more illuminating is what I had for lunch, which was spaghetti alla papalina, followed by a cotoletta bolognese con spinaci ripassati, washed down with a lovely bottle of Chianti.
Okay, so we're taking you behind the scenes, and it can be pretty messy, kind of like the sausage factory. And what I mean is all that tape that ends up on the cutting room floor, hours upon hours of perfect moments that just don't fit into the story. Producer Bradley Campbell came into the studio to share one such moment from this past year.
Okay, Carol, for me in 2014, it had to be the moment when I interviewed this immensely popular indie band from Chicago, OK Go. So they had just dropped another viral video upon the world. Millions of people watched it. And my story was about, you know, the process of working on a video when you don't speak the language or really know much about the culture. Because OK Go filmed the video in Japan, Japanese crew, director, choreographer, dancers, and the like.
So what's the kind of tape that you couldn't end up using?
Well, you know, I thought I'd give them, you know, a warm-up question, just a throwaway one. The best places to eat in Chicago, because that's where the guys are from. But I had no idea that I would get this.
Best places to eat in Chicago. There's only really one, and it is the Maxwell Street Hot Dog Stand. It's good. Yeah. There's them some good hot dogs.
That's good sausage.
That's good sausage. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I suppose we should be talking Chicago.
Yeah.
So, I know, right? It's a really great piece of tape from a couple rock stars. Now, you never get that tape. But here's the thing, Carol. They kept on riffing.
Other good places to eat in Chicago, hot dogs.
Hot dogs is good, but it's a little bit,
it's kind of bougie.
It's kind of bourgeois, yeah. You know what I mean?
It's a little bit bourgeois.
But, you know, you can get a good rattlesnake sausage there.
Yeah,
I like that.
Kangaroo.
I'm sure there's like, I'm sure you can get all kinds of, like, you could probably get a bear sausage.
Maybe even raccoon.
Or you could get raccoon. I mean, I don't know if I have the tolerance to eat a raccoon myself, but, you know, I give it a shot.
Sure, give it a shot. You probably like it.
I mean, hey, there's all kinds of different sausages out there.
Oh, yeah.
You got to try them all.
Oh, yeah. I was talking to Officer Wyszynski about hot dogs and sausages.
Oh, yeah, hot dogs. It's a good place. I mean, good thing we're not on the air yet because I can say this. Sometimes I come out of there with kind of a fiery
Whoa.
Okay,
these guys are good.
Okay. Now, joking aside, though, Carol, I do want to stress that Chicago really does have amazing sausage.
Okay. Well, finally, I wanted to end with our resident historian here in the newsroom, producer Christopher Wolfe. Chris, you cover a lot of the hard news for us here at The World. So what did you pick?
Well, Carol, I picked an interview that I produced with Marco Werman back in September with Harvard psychologist Steven Pinker. Now, I love history, and I love statistics, I'm not afraid to say it. And I saw this article from him discussing whether violence and bloodshed and war in the world was up or down since his 2011 book, The Better Angels of Our Nature. And the conclusion of both book and the new article is that this is, in fact, one of the most peaceful and non-violent eras in the entire human existence. So I was pretty skeptical until I took a long, hard look at his data, compared it to some other sources, and so we got him into the studio, and he said it was all pretty easy to explain.
If you get your view of the world from the news, you're always going to think that we're living in violent times, because if anything blows up, if there's any shooting anywhere in the world, it instantly gets beamed across the globe. News is about stuff that happens. It's not about stuff that doesn't happen, and as long as violence hasn't gone down to zero, there'll always be enough incidents to fill the news. You really could only get a sense of how violent the world is and what the trends are if you count. If you also look at all the places in the world that aren't blowing up, and that is not going to be on the news. You never see a reporter standing on the streets of Mozambique or Colombia saying there's no war this year. But there were wars in past years, and we forget about them because they aren't news. What you have to do, of course, is count the number of wars, count the number of people killed in war, plot the trend over time. That's how you get a picture of whether the world has become more or less violent. It's the only way to get such a picture.
So we got a hugely positive response from listeners to that story, Carol. You know, huge number of shares online, because it was, you know, it's such a great antidote to all the grim stuff that people usually hear.
So I'm curious, Chris, you are a war buff, a history buff, and you're kind of the shoot 'em up guy in terms of analysis. How did Pinker make you feel?
Yeah, I'm sorry to say, dealing with the war and terrorism is kind of my bread and butter, and the history stuff is kind of a bit of relief. But it does wear you down. So I'm in the same boat as the listeners. It's great to be reminded of the importance of actual data and not just the kind of impressions you get from just dealing with individual tragedies. And we've also tried to like incorporate it into our journalism a little bit. So we're doing a story on like murder in Mexico. And then so I said, well, what is the big picture here? So if you look back 30 or 40 or 50 years, you find that the homicide rate in Mexico, even with all the horror stories we hear, is actually much, much lower than it was in the past.
Thanks, Chris. It's an interesting perspective to keep in mind as we report the news in the new year. And our production staff is looking forward to a whole new bunch of favorite news stories in 2015. Right now, we turn it over to our director, April Peavy, to take us to the break with one of her musical selections. And after that, we'll remember some of the musicians we lost in the past year. You're listening to the New Year's Day edition of The World.
And you're listening to 91.5 FM KJZZ. You can stream us online at kjzz.org. Checking traffic right now. I-17 southbound at Deer Valley Road is now showing clear. There had been a report earlier of a dead animal in the roadway. ADOT, however, is reporting that Interstate 40 up north is still closed in both directions. That's from US 93 near Kingman all the way to Williams due to ice and snow. Still no word yet on when that particular stretch of the interstate will reopen.
KJZZ is supported by the Piper Center for Creative Writing at ASU, hosting the 2015 Desert Nights Rising Stars Writers Conference, February 19th to 21st, Writing, Revising, Publishing. Registration at piper.asu.edu.
Still looking for a high in the valley today of 48 degrees. Right now, it's 45 in Glendale, 43 in Scottsdale, 43 in Chandler, partly sunny skies, and 44 degrees in Phoenix at 2:50.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody, along with Steve Goldstein. With our partners at The World, we're keeping you connected with stories from Phoenix and around the globe.
You know, sometimes journalism can be a rocky road, and sometimes you have to really mint a complicated turn of phrase. And
okay,
know,
Steve, we get it. You've got ice cream on the brain.
You know, you're right, Mark. I was thinking of the time you and I had what was easily the toughest assignment of our careers, touring and tasting our way through the heart of Cold Stone Creamery.
My name is Ray Karam. I'm the senior taste master for Cold Stone Creamery, which amounts to research and development in ice cream.
Yep. This guy has the job you know you want. He develops and tastes new flavors of ice cream for a living. We met up with him in his lab.
And yes, he was wearing a lab coat.
But instead of beakers and Bunsen burners, Karam's lab looks a lot like any Cold Stone you'd walk into.
And yeah, we met him there at 9:30 a.m. Mark, you and I were still trying to get rid of the taste of toothpaste from our mouths, but not Ray, as you found out.
I gotta ask you, do you ever get tired of eating ice cream?
Never. Never. In fact, I had some just a few minutes ago before you got here. I love it. I've had it for breakfast. Sometimes I'll be eating ice cream alone by myself, and an idea will spark.
How do you come up with new flavors? I mean, where do these ideas come from?
Sometimes they just rattle around in my head, and I gotta get them out. You know, when I did maple bacon, you know, who puts meat in ice cream? But there are other people doing the same thing, and these ideas happen simultaneously. So they come from within. They come from whatever the promotion is, the marketing promotion, whether it's a holiday or a celebration or a charity. We do a lot of charity work. And then finally is trends in culinary. We rely on not only everybody in the department watching culinary trends, but salespeople that come to visit us.
So what are the trends in culinary that you guys are looking at right now?
Well, right off the bat, I can tell you that there's lots of movement towards chocolate. There's movement to make the tongue pop, so to speak. In other words, hit all those sensory points on your tongue. You can taste sweet, sour, salty, bitter. Bitter, not such a great one, but the other three, if you can get your tongue firing on all these pistons, it's a great flavor.
But Karam says sales are always there for one of Cold Stone's most popular flavors, cake batter, and he showed us how the magic is made.
So we start off with the liquid ice cream mix.
The mix Karam starts with is sweet cream. He then adds the cake batter flavoring.
Okay, so here we go.
Got a whisk on there.
Whisk. You got to be coordinated in this as you shake it in.
Now, Ray, when I make cake or cookies, I sometimes eat the batter even though you're not supposed to. Do you do that?
Yes, and you can do that with this because it has only ready-to-eat ingredients in there. There's nothing raw about this.
Karam then sends the mixture into a machine, starts to freeze it, adds air, and lets it gel into its more familiar form. And a few minutes later...
So this is pan number one. Feel free. I never deprive anybody in the second spoon, including myself.
Now, we should pause here just to say that this was, without question, the most amazing ice cream either of us had ever tasted. It looked like soft serve and was only seconds old when we tasted its chilled goodness.
And then we had to get back to business. Karam wrapped the pan in paper, puts it in the deep freezer, and asks what may be a rhetorical question.
You know, how can you be in a bad mood with eating ice cream? I mean, it's impossible.
By that logic, yeah, Karam is probably in a good mood a lot of the time.
But our interview couldn't just be all cookie dough and crushed peppermint.
Wait, why not?
Well, I had to ask him about the pressure of creating flavors for one of the world's biggest ice cream makers.
I think if I allowed that to happen, mistakes would happen, and we've had very few mistakes over the year. We test exhaustively to make sure this is the one we want to go with and that marketing gets behind it. So, you know, I don't allow that pressure to kind of go, and I just kind of zen it all right in there, you know.
How do you keep ice cream being that kind of American thing? Recently, you know, we had a lot of stories about real estate, and oh my gosh, the American dream is buying a house until the housing market crashed. As people's diets change and whatnot, how do you keep ice cream at the fore of what people want?
You know, I think the best thing is to keep it simple. If you look at the ingredients on our ice cream, they are the simple, most wholesome ingredients you can put in ice cream. I think as long as you don't get too exotic, like sea urchin ice cream, you know, you'll hit the high points and people will love it. So good foundation, good American flavors, you know, using common ingredients in a unique way.
But that doesn't mean Karam isn't thinking about what's next. And no, it doesn't include anything from the sea.
That seems like a missed opportunity, but he is working on a flavor for a certain February holiday.
I'm not a chocolate guy, but I will tell you, I literally crave this.
You just lost half our audience, thank you.
Well, but fear not. We have more in this ice cream coming up for Valentine's Day. Our first promotion of the year starts in mid-January, and it's fudge truffle ice cream. And if you've ever had a truffle candy, great sensation, lots of I love this. Imagine that frozen into an ice cream. And this thing delivers. I've seen women's knees buckle on this thing just by the first bite.
And speaking of bites, were we? Well, we are now. Before we left, Karam led us behind the counter to show us how he teaches trainees the tools of the trade.
Let's do a strawberry. I'm feeling strawberry today.
He decides to add sliced strawberries to his strawberry ice cream, as well as chocolate chips and caramel.
All right, so now we do the folding in of the ingredients. Chop up the strawberries a little bit.
But don't let Karam's enthusiasm for making the ice cream fool you. It's all done with a goal in mind.
The best thing to do is eat it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you like it. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of surprised.
Man, it is a real shame he didn't like that, like, at all.
Seriously. And if you can believe it, Ray actually let Mark have a go with the scoopers. You can see what flavor he chose. There's video and a bunch of pictures at KJZZ.org. If it weren't for air conditioning, most of us probably wouldn't live in the valley. However, climate control is one of the main contributors to electric bills. And as winter approaches, heating costs can add to that burden. Before the summer heat returns, consumers looking to lower their costs can take advantage of a home energy audit. Glendale resident Matt Shannon decided it was time for a change after noticing his bills were almost twice that of his neighbors and climbing.
We want to find out what we can do to reel that in. And then obviously there's some behaviors that go along with power usage, but in terms of the home itself, that's where we're starting from today.
So he set up an appointment with Elena Cremat and Alex Williams of Ideal Energy. They helped identify savings opportunities around Shannon's house, like a new pump for the pool, installing energy-efficient bulbs, and sealing up outlets. Williams finds one troublesome spot on the second floor.
And so, Matt, your filter here is a little bit dirty. I know with these, it's kind of like out of sight, out of mind. You don't really see it. But, you know, especially during the summer months, just making sure that this is changed out, that's something that impacts efficiency as far as the AC unit goes.
Back downstairs, Cremat sets up a blower fan on Shannon's front door.
So right now we're just depressurizing the house. This way we can see how leaky the entire building is as a whole. And then what we're going to do now, we're going to measure to see how leaky the ductwork is.
After completing a full assessment of the house, they'll recommend changes Shannon can make to save up to 10 to 30% on his monthly bill. However, those changes come at a high cost. A new pool pump alone could cost several $1,000s, but APS provides rebates to offset some of the expense. APS program manager Maggie Gibbs says funding for the home audit program comes from ratepayers.
So there is a charge on customers' bills that a certain piece of that bill is actually going into these energy efficiency programs. So greatly benefits customers who participate in them since they're paying for them.
Despite positive feedback for the home energy audit program, its future is uncertain. The Arizona Corporation Commission is currently reviewing the state's energy efficiency policies and could potentially remove them altogether.
Thanks for listening to the show today. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. Happy New Year. This is listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD.
Good afternoon. All Things Considered is next on your community news station, KJZZ. Stay with us at 6 for Marketplace, and at 6:30, it's the newsroom from the BBC.
The drawbacks of crowdfunding a science experiment.
You really need an expert to be able to look at that and say, well, you know, this really is new and interesting, or, in fact, this is like something that's already been done.
I'm David Gura. Why some researchers are turning to online donors when federal funding falls short. Next time on Marketplace from APM.
And that is Marketplace tonight at 6 on KJZZ. Well, here's some good news. ADOT is reporting that Interstate 40 has reopened in both directions in northern Arizona between Kingman and Williams. It had been closed most of the day due to icy road conditions. Still looking for a high of 48.